This episode is brought to you by D7. Find out why every tech should have a copy of D7 by visiting foolishit.com. And don't forget to catch the Podnuts episode, Podnuts episode 74 with the creator, Nick Shaw.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Linux for the Rest of Us, episode 139. This is a show about Linux. We cover Linux news, software, hardware, anything that tickles our Linux fancy. I don't know why I still say that. I said that randomly once.
Because you like tickle.
I enjoy tickling my son because he giggles, but he's not on this show. I'm going to come up with a new intro. Bill Wilson, call him Bill Wilson now. He helped me with the outro. He can help me with the intro. If there's one man that can do it, it's Red.
Mm-hmm. Red.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm Cody Cooper, a.k.a. Super Coop. And I'm here every week, as I am, blessed to be here with my good friend, the Linux Maven, Door-to-Door Geek, a.k.a. Steve McLaughlin. How's it going, Door?
Hey. Took off work today, and I basically slept all day. I was tired. You know, 3-4 hours sleep a night kind of catches up with you.
Dude, you and me both. I passed out while playing a video game in my front room. But I have this plastic rocking chair. It's called the AK Rocker. Imagine like a bucket seat racing chair, but it's a little rocking chair. I fell asleep in it, but I fell backward all the way back to where my back was on the ground and I couldn't like move, so I literally needed to roll out of the chair, which caused it to come out in pieces.
Nice.
Yeah. When I sleep like a boss.
So do it.
So I did that. So are you well rested?
No, I woke up, and about 4 hours later, I wanted to take a nap.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I mean, that just means that you love your sleep, and there's nothing wrong with that. Don't let anyone tell you.
I do. I do love my sleep. And around the age of 20 or so, I remember hearing a study that said people who sleep between 7 and 8 hours a night tend to live the longest. And I just said, oh, guess I'm going to die young. The next.
Yeah. Oh, well, you and I should have a sleep deprivation story podcast. We'll do a pilot of that in the near future because I'm sure you and I both have some great stories when it's concerning that topic.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
All right.
Now, we had different plans for this episode, though, right?
Yes. Yeah. This episode, we're going to try to keep short. Although that's almost cursing it by saying that aloud. We're not going to do a traditional show this week. We're just going to get caught up on emails and some voicemails that we've been not necessarily neglecting, but we've been pinching them in, you know, into shows.
No, dude, I've been neglecting voicemails. If you sent a voicemail in and you do not hear it, nail me in my mouth. Send me an email and say, when are you going to play my voicemail, man? Because if I don't play voicemails every show, it's very easy for me to forget voicemails. I think I said that last episode.
Mm-hmm.
So I found one today with the help of the owner of the voicemail saying, what's up? You ain't going to play my voicemail, man? And it isn't that we didn't want to. It's that it got lost in the daily shuffle grind of email.
Well, I will say I took my inbox down today from 285 down to 48.
Good man.
So yeah, and I'm gonna inbox zero it tonight if I die trying.
Well, here's one thing I always have a problem with: how to organize inbox. Because do you use labels? Do you use stars? Do you use tags? All of that means work, and more work. So it's hard to do.
Well, I tag it like I have one for this show, then I have one for, you know, specific people and like organizations, you know, products I've bought, Amazon, you know, eBay, whatever. So I'll tag it when it comes in, and then if it's something that I need to action, but I don't have time to action it right now, I'll star it and leave it in the inbox. But for instance, when I get an email for the show, I will star it and then tag it. And then when I've actually copied the text from the email into our document, then I just kick it over into the folder, into the label folder, to where it's not in my inbox anymore.
Well, two just super quickies then before we get started. One, if anyone out there listening knows of a great podcast episode, I don't need an entire series, just an episode or two on email management and, you know, best ways to do it, like GTD on email, send it my way. I'm always interested in that kind of thing. And two, if people out there didn't know, the guy by the name of Alton Brown, who did this show on the old Food Network called Good Eats, now has a podcast. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's over at the Nerdist podcast, which immediately makes it lose miles of credibility in my book. It's actually pretty good. I really do respect him for his knowledge, and I really like the way he communicates. If you're interested in food, dare I say chemistry, and how to do stuff different and better, and how and why food does what it does, I encourage you to go check out that Alton Brown cast, I believe it's called.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a great guy. Filmmaking background, and then went to culinary school later in life, and then merged the two with his Food Network show. I believe it was Food Network. Good Eats. Great show. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's on YouTube. Go check it out.
Oh, yeah. Thank God it is, too, because I can't stand TV. Commercials.
Okay, well, we're just going to roll right into the first email. I alluded last week that Matthew Gardner wrote in, and he had since followed up and sent us some details on this, which we'll put in the show notes. But Matthew Gardner writes, every single Linux podcast I listen to has had email or callers baffled by dual booting, managing partitions, and every solution I have heard has been overly complicated. I seem to remember Cody saying he actually moves the SATA cables to the drive he wants to boot from, which is true. I do that often. While that works, there is an easier way to accomplish this, and the end result is much less pet hair on your motherboard. The first thing to do on a new install is replace Grub 2 with Grub Legacy. Remember Grub Legacy? It was simple, configurable, and did the job. Grub 2 is like GNOME 3. It solves a problem that never existed, but I digress. Grub Legacy, along with the Super Grub boot disk, allows you to not only choose your default boot partition, but have Grub on all partitions in case one goes south. When you boot from Super Grub boot disk, you can change the default boot partition on the fly, and the changes stick until you change it. If you have Windows as well, you never have to worry about breaking the ever-so-fragile master boot record if you use these two tools. iPentaBoot, running Ubuntu, Zubuntu, Puppy Linux, Windows 7, and Linux Flavor of the Month.
Wow.
I have been doing this since 2006, and through countless upgrades, reinstalls, and trying distros on my third hard drive, the bootloader has never been lost nor broken. I even changed computers back in March of last year and kept all my distros intact on my desktop. This March, I got a new laptop and did the same thing. Creating partitions is a cakewalk using a single tool that you already have, gparted. For a fresh install, simply partition the disk from the live CD before you begin the install and set the bootloader to run from the root partition of the distro you are installing. Then use the Super Grub boot CD to boot from the new install. Then remove Grub 2 and reinstall Grub Legacy. Boot again from the older Super Grub CD, the one made from Grub Legacy, and you can change the boot partition to default to the new distro's location. If Windows is on the system, it leaves the master boot record untouched, and Windows will be in the Grub menu as well, chain loading to the Windows loader. If you need to change the drive or partition location of Windows or Linux, or move either to a larger or smaller drive or partition, there is an infinitely easier way to do it than fiddling with the DD command or Clonezilla, both of which can lead to disaster if you're not careful or familiar with them. Again, gparted to the rescue. Simply click the partition you are going to move, then either right-click or select from the menu button the option Copy. Then navigate to the new drive/partition and select Paste. This will byte-copy the entire drive to the new drive or partition, and you can even resize it before you apply. It even gives it the same UUID, so Grub will work without error, assuming you are using UUID in lieu of SDA1, etc., to identify your partitions. If you are then inclined to keep both installs, you can use Tune2FS, that is T-U-N-E, the number 2FS, to assign a new UUID to the old partition. Then copy-paste it into your Grub menu so you can boot off of either one. I have used this so I can have two identical installs of Ubuntu, then beat the snot out of one of them, testing all kinds of crazy things until I break it, and I have also used it to make a backup copy of a perfectly tweaked system to a fresh hard drive. The possibilities are endless. I have attached the commands to revert to Grub Legacy from a post I found when Grub 2 came out several years ago. Sorry this took so long to send to you. Keep up the awesome work, Matthew.
First off, Matthew never has to apologize. he's been on and off emailing me, communicating with me about stuff. And I got to tell you, man, he considers himself to be very new. It sounds like he's actually pretty smart. And I think because he's thinking out of the box, that's why I think he's been so successful with Linux. I used to do something just like this. The biggest difference between this and how every distro is now today with Grub 2.0 or whatever the version number is Grub Legacy lets you have what I would call modularized operating systems, which meant if you had five partitions on your drive, you could have everything regarding that operating system on that partition, including its boot manager, which would enable you to just copy an entire partition and you had everything in the operating system. Where if you do it now with Grub 2, if you copy the partition, it still won't boot because there's no Grub for it to handle. I used to do something almost like this with the old Grub Legacy. I always said install Grub on not the master boot record, but the current partition or the root partition. And then I used a application called GAG, G-A-G, which I will find right now and make sure there is a link to it in the show notes. It's a graphical boot manager that you can put on a CD and you can install to the master boot record. So I would have it on my CD and I would boot to my CD every time. And then from the CD, I would say boot to third partition. Third partition would be Red Hat. Reboot the computer, boot to the CD, say boot to partition one. That's Windows. And that's how I would do it. I would dynamically on the fly pick what I was booting to. And so, it meant less stuff broke.
So this GAG disk sort of was like a middleman to get you to switch.
Yeah, he still has a Grub Legacy also on the main master boot record.
Oh, okay.
And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. I just wanted to try GAG because, honestly, I also used to use it as a tech because that would enable me to boot to hidden partitions and do a restore on a Windows computer without knowing a complicated keyboard combination during boot to initiate that restore, because on every computer it was different. Shift and F10, Control F11. I didn't want to know those keyboard combinations, so I used GAG for that.
Okay. Well, we are going to have, and he sent some detailed commands, which we'll have Paul put in the show notes. Thank you, Paul. And thank you, Matthew, for the very detailed email.
Yeah, and I will say I heard about it before. I always forget about it, and I never remember to try it. But he uses Gparted to copy partitions. This is fantastic in my eyes. I love the idea of this. Because if you can't use this tool to copy a partition to a new drive, you need to learn how to spell. I don't know, because it is that easy of a tool to use. Gparted, I think, is the best GUI tool to do advanced things, and I just love it. I love it.
Well, and from what he's saying too, you can also resize the partition. For instance, if you have a 250 gig drive in an old laptop and you upgrade it to 500, well, now you have more space. If you want to allocate more space to that partition, you just do it right in Gparted and then just move it over. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that is great. And I always use Gparted every time I install because I always boot to a live CD, load Gparted, and I condition the partitions in that tool. Then I boot into the whatever distro I'm going to install, and I just pick the partitions where I want stuff to go. I don't know why I always do it like that. I feel safer doing it like that. Mm-hmm. That's just, you know, I guess a habit now I do. We do have the commands, and I will say your process, Cody, is much less work up front. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then as the life of you using this goes on, you always have to do a little bit of work where you have to bend over, plug, reboot. Matthew's is a little bit of work up front, but then it's no work after the fact. So it's a question of, do you mind doing it up front or do you mind doing it over the long haul? And I'll say there's nothing wrong with both ways.
Well, and with his method, what I'm going to try and what I would suggest for people who are new to this is try it with just two OSs first, or two flavors of Linux, if that's what you're doing, if you're in a dual boot, or, you know, how are you going to do it? Because it's something that I want to get used to, because I have some big drives, some big fast drives that I wouldn't mind using for testing, and having to just blow away a partition versus the entire drive and starting over. It's going to save me time in the long run, but potentially having, you know, 3, 4, or in his case, 5 pentabooting, right, ready, you know, 100 gigs or whatever, you know, just right off the bat, ready for me at any time, and being able to switch to them in software versus physically doing it. Because I'm always very careful in the way I do it, but God forbid if you pulled out either the data or the power cable off your drive a little bit too fast and broke one of those pins.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
I would freak out.
Oh, so would I. I mean, I'm always very careful, you know, I've built machines for years, so I'm very, you know, comfortable doing that. But for someone new, if they were, you know, unfamiliar with that process or had never done it before, it could lead to some disastrous results. But Matt, thank you. I'm going to commit to doing it sometime in the next 30 days because I'm still revamping my whole office. It's looking a lot better now. Not back there where you can see. It's still a complete heap behind me, but in front of me, it looks much better.
Right.
Very cool. Well, thank you, Matthew. All right, let's go down here. So Ray Woods writes in. He says,
okay. Super quick.
Okay.
There's two Rays that have been around Podnuts, I swear, the first week it started. This is one of those Rays. I cannot thank Ray enough through all of the hard times, all of the work that has to be done on the back end. Ray always sends good stuff, positive emails, and when a show's late and coming out, he's the guy who seemingly always emails me first. There's always one Ray that does it. Always goes back and forth. And he's like, is there a show? The show didn't stop, did it? And I'm like, no, I'm just a little behind. I'm sorry. I'll hurry up. And he's always polite about it, and he always supports the network. So I got to do that shout out for Ray.
Very cool. Yeah, Ray has contributed. He's written in many times. And I know he's done stuff for the network as well, so we do appreciate it. But he wrote in, and he says, hi, guys. I know you don't get paid for this service you provide to the Linux world, but were you referring to any specific Friday? The last edition was published on June 26th, and today is July 10th. Hey, guys, I'm starting to twitch. I've got withdrawal symptoms. Bad, man. My fingers twitch every time I click on Linux the Rest of Us shortcut. I know it's hard work, guys, but we're suffering out here. I hope to hear from you again soon. Hope everything is okay, Ray. Ray, yeah. Everything's fine. We switched from Tuesdays to Fridays, but we did have a gap there due to some circumstances. But I can safely say that we're going to be weekly from now on. I know that, you know, like I'm going on vacation sometime next month and Dor has things pop up. But we have Martin Rambo Obando, who is willing and able to step in to fill the shoes if there's any sort of a gap. But I mean, things do happen. Unfortunately, we've had a few gaps in the last few months that were somewhat unavoidable. But if we plan ahead like we are now, then those will cease to happen.
Well, and I won't lie, okay? I really want to expand Podnuts. I don't want Podnuts to stay stagnant. I want it to get bigger and better. Also, I have to fulfill Kickstarter obligations, I'll say. I made obligations that said I would do 5 video series in a year, and it's almost a year and I haven't done one. Rephrase that. I haven't completed one. I've started at least 4 of them, and, you know, 10, 15, 20 hours into it, I'm like, this is not working right. This is not how I envision this product to end up. So I've scratched. I've asked Steve for input. Me and Steve started to do a video series, and then we both got to a point like 4 hours into it, and we said, where's this going? What is this doing? He said, you know, you were thinking this could be a lot of hours of content, and as it turns out, this might be an hour's worth of content. I'm like, dude, I guess I'm saying it too fast. It's just, you know, there isn't as much as I thought there was. So I am trying to do, and the whole thing is I want to do video series right. I don't want to have them come out half-baked. I do not want them to come out with normal content that isn't well-received. I want to do this thing right. So I'm trying to do video content. I'm trying to do more podcast. I'm trying to do management of the back end of Podnuts, and I'm trying to do Linux for the rest of us. Once in a while, something falls off, and I try to make it not this show. I will say that.
And we, like I said, Martin is perfectly willing to help, and there may be times where Dora's like, hey, can I take a week off and do some work on this? And by all means, go ahead. You know, we can run it here and hold down the fort for you. But yeah, we as of right now, yeah, we are officially switched to Fridays, usually airing sometime between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're trying to keep it, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 to 10 Eastern. Usually around the middle of that hour we try to start. So if you want to watch us live, by all means, follow us on Google+. Dora's very good about posting the live link most weeks, and you can watch live. But Ray, stop twitching. You're going to be fine. At worst case scenario, man, send in a number where I can send you like a voicemail, and I'll give you a little micro episode if you really, really need it, because I don't want you endangering your health here, dude. I just don't. Okay. So, Ken Westby writes, "Hi, Doran Cody. I have a Lexmark printer. My friend has a Brother printer. One of the major frustrations with Linux Mint is getting our printers to actually print something. My Lexmark printer will install properly, but it will not actually print anything. It says printing canceled after I send something to the printer. My friend's printer driver acts like it is installed, but then you can't find it afterwards. Can you give us some hints as to how in the world to get printers to actually work in Linux Mint? Not being able to print is keeping both of us from throwing away Windows altogether. Very frustrating. Love listening to the show. Keep up the great work. Ken Westby from Squim, Washington." And it is pronounced a squim, but it's spelled S-E-Q-U-I-M. But he went to the extra length of making sure I knew how to pronounce it. So I did.
Thank you. Because I wouldn't have thought that was squim.
Mm-mm.
Okay. Ken, let me first tell you, we should have a toast right here. Me and Ken virtually, because I understand what he's saying, okay? Printers in Linux used to be the bane of its existence. Audio, okay, long time ago, audio was the bane of its existence. To get audio working right and to be able to do multiple things at the same time, like you're listening to an audio track, yet you hear a beep from an application, was in... Oh, it's so hard. Printing is still a bit of a bane of people's existence. Now, I will say, the default answer is always a bad answer for people, which is, well, you should investigate your printer before you go out and buy one. Which, it has validity to it. If you do that, then you will always be happy and satisfied. It will work great. Not everybody has that luxury. We have printers given to us. We have printers that are already in existence before we come to Linux. So there's two things I'm going to say. Number one, if printing is utilized at your house to any degree, more than one page a month kind of thing, you should not run Ubuntu. You should absolutely not run Linux Mint. I said it. You shouldn't. What you should run is OpenSUSE, okay?
Mm-hmm.
OpenSUSE is the only distribution right now in existence that has this feature, okay? And here's the feature. You turn your computer on. You log in to OpenSUSE. You have the desktop up. You take your printer, you plug it into the wall, then you plug it into your computer. Then you cross your arms, cross your eyes, look up and down, then go to your printer settings on your computer, and it's already installed and configured for a large percentage of printers. There is zero work involved here, people, when you use OpenSUSE. That is a feature I want more Linux distributions to adopt now, okay? Now, with that said, if you still insist on using a different distribution or it doesn't, or that trick doesn't work, because it doesn't work on all printers. It works on printers that, I can't remember the right word. Acceptable printers, I guess. I don't know. But
compatible?
Compatible. And there is over 25,000 printers compatible with that service in OpenSUSE, okay? Mm-hmm. After that, the Linux Foundation has a site called openprinting.org, okay? This is not the end answer for printing as well, but if your printer doesn't work, this can help easy. This can help identify your problem or give you a solution to make it work. If you go to openprinting.org/printers, there is a wizard-type form where you select your manufacturer, then you show the printer. Then it tells you the name of the driver and the percentage of compatibility you have. Because sometimes it's 100%. Color will work great. The DPI will work great. A will just work great. Sometimes it literally says like 60% compatibility because it will print black and white, but it will not print in color. Or you can get up to 800 DPI, but this driver only goes to 400 DPI. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you can get partial usage out of it. I will say, if you do want me to look into printers for you, anybody out there, I need specific model numbers. And what I mean by that is, don't just read the number off the front of the printer. Open the top up or read off the back, and there's typically one or two more digits on that part number, okay? He gave me his Lexmark version. The Lexmark series is not even in openprinting.org, so there is zero compatibility with that printer. So Linux Mint saying it's installed and configured is lying to you, is the best way I can put it. It's not, because it doesn't work.
It's probably just saying, yeah, there's a USB device, and I recognize that we've made a connection, so therefore I'll communicate that, but it doesn't actually work.
Right. It's like a Lexmark Pro series, I want to say, and there is no Pro series anywhere on OpenPrinting. Mm-hmm. I literally did a Google site search for the word Pro series. There is no existence of it on the website, so I don't know how he's going to get that working. I said, look, if you really like that printer, you really want that printer, then you need to have a Windows box in your house and have that printer connected to that.
Could you just run Windows in a VM and accomplish the same thing?
Yes, but I'm a little hesitant because what if it's a shared printer in the house and then mom tries to print and says, why isn't this printing? Why isn't this printing? Why isn't this printing? Yeah. Well, because the VM isn't loaded. The what? She doesn't want to hear that kind of answer. But if it's just you in that one house, it's possible to do it that way, especially if it's a network printer. You can do it from a VM, and it should work fine. I'll say that.
And then here's a couple points I'll bring up, because I ran into a similar problem. I have an older Canon PhotoSmart printer. It's a kind of, when I bought it, it was kind of a mid-range, color printer. And I just mainly use it for text documents. This past March or February, when I did my taxes, I've used the same accountant for, I don't know, 10, 15 years now. He's a guy in my hometown, so I literally just drive down there every year and have him do them because I trust him. But he will email me documents to sign once the paperwork is all done, and I'll have to mail them back to him. Well, this year, I couldn't get my printer to work again, and I was just like, forget it. I'm just going to go buy a printer. So I went on to openprinting.org. I checked. There was if you're going to buy a printer now and you want it compatible with your Linux machine, buy an HP printer. First of all, you're not going to worry about all the garbage drivers on that disk, because they're not going to work on Linux, right? Number two, they have a great tool. I want to say it's the HP Printer Toolkit, which helps you look for the exact printer you have, an exact model. And trust me, that drop-down menu is huge. And it installs it, and they do constant updates to it. That is one of the things that HP does really well on Linux, I will say that. But I ended up buying just the cheapest HP printer I could at Walmart. Got home, printed out the documents, but then I thought, wait a minute, can I just send these to him digitally? So I emailed him and asked him if scans would work, and he said, yeah, that'll totally work. So then there's an Android application, which Dorn knows and has used,
Cam Scanner
Pro.
Oh, yeah.
I just, I, I, uh, I digitally was able to import the PDF, sign I was able to take a photo of the paperwork, and then use another Android app called DocuSync.
Yeah. Sounds right.
To digitally sign it and then export it as a PDF and then email it to him. And then I ended up just taking the printer back because I didn't even need it. So ask yourself, what do you need the printer for? A lot of people say, I have to print photos. No, you don't, because it's a convoluted process. It's just too expensive for the consumers. Everybody has a Walmart or a Walgreens or a Costco nearby.
That's what we do, yeah.
Export the photos onto... You can even email it into their web service, which I don't like to do because then it degrades the quality. Go in with a USB drive, plug it in, print them right there. You're going to save a lot of money. But if for some reason you need to print off a lot of documents at home, which I understand there are cases for that, then consider purchasing and making a $30 investment in a $34 investment in a newer printer, especially if it's black and white. The ink's going to be cheap. Monoprice sells a lot of ink cartridges now. You can get replacements there because, God, don't pay the retail for, you know, you'll pay for two cartridges. It'll be the cost of some of those lower-end printers. So, yeah, unfortunately, you know, when you're going into it, you know, all the other peripherals, you know, your hard drives, your keyboard and mouse, they're all going to work. But the printer is still kind of the bane of this problem. So if you have hardware you're bringing over into this experience, that might be the one thing that you are not going to be able to do. But reevaluate why you need it and see if you can find some alternatives that are not only going to save you money in the long run, but potentially frustration.
Yeah, and I will throw this out there, okay? If you have to print, okay, and you don't have a printer yet, extremely listen to this right here. Go to eBay, search for HP LaserJet 4 or LaserJet 4L. L as in Larry. What you will find is a printer probably looks like it's about 10 years old. Buy that printer. I have seen those printers literally print millions of pages and not die. The toner is not expensive. I have one sitting over here when I need to print something, which of course is never. And it's a laser cartridge, which means it doesn't dry out. They will work forever, and they will work anywhere. Now, super quick also. Everybody who's ran Windows and has had to load an HP printer, you have to, Cody said it, but I have to hit it home harder. Your experience with HP printers on Windows is the exact opposite on Linux. There is near nothing to install. There is no such thing as bloatware. There is no 600 megabyte download of a driver on Linux. HP on Linux is gold. Absolute gold. On Windows, I will rather push my head through a plate glass window than install an HP driver. On Linux, it's a joy.
Mm-hmm. Very, very easy. So yeah, if you're looking for a printer, definitely consider HP, but ultimately go to openprinting.org, see if your printer is compatible first, save yourself some money and some time.
Yes.
All right.
And I did put a link in there to the documentation of the OpenSUSE automatic printer configuration. I'm very serious. If load up a live CD, people, and see if it loads it for you. If it does, there's nothing wrong with OpenSUSE. I firmly believe it's the most underrated distribution on the market today. And I don't like RPM distros, and I just said that.
Yeah, wow. I'm gonna buy you an OpenSUSE shirt and make you wear it at OMF.
Yeah, well.
But I'm going to put like a fedora. I'm gonna cut it in half. Whoa, he's holding up an OpenSUSE disk.
I literally have one sitting right here because I was seriously considering dual booting it on this computer over here just because, I don't know.
Well, you can do it because you can do it, and you're going to do it because you can.
Yeah.
And you can use Matthew Gardner's Grub Legacy trick and then not worry about losing any partitions. Or messing up your master boot record for that secret 500 gig Windows partition you have on all your machines.
Oh, and it's a double-sided disk. You don't see that too often. One side is 64-bit, one side is 32-bit.
You didn't even hear me say that.
Yes, I did.
What did I say?
Matthew Grub tricks. I don't lose anything.
Like what?
Like anything.
Everybody next listening email. To me. Yeah, okay, here we go.
Damn it.
Okay, what? So Rick Crouch writes, lately I've gotten my 10-year-old daughter interested in programming by having her learn Scratch, which I discovered on my Raspberry Pi when I set it up. She has been using my wife's Windows Vista laptop, yeah. laptop, and a 10-year-old XP laptop. Today, I set her up on Linux Mint on a 5-year-old Athlon 64 desktop that was gathering dust. She loves it. She said, "It's so fast." And it is. I was really surprised by the performance of this dinosaur of a desktop. Rock on Linux. Rick. P.S. Next challenge. Try Mint on the ancient laptop to see if it can be brought back from the trash heap. Very cool, Rick. Yeah, I'll say it's always amazing what you can do with old hardware. I have a couple of... I actually have a couple old HPs, which I got off of a customer well over 2 years ago. One of them has an Intel quad-core chip, and then one of them has an Athlon 64, I think a dual-core chip in it. And yeah, I've thrown flavors of Mint and Puppy and just all sorts of stuff on there just to kind of see if it would work, and it did. And I used one of them for one of my loaner machines when I ran my computer repair business. And yeah, it's I'm all really about not forking out a lot of money for the really top-end hardware, because if I look around at just what I have right now, I'm not using it. I mean, I see a couple laptops over there. I got almost dead iMac up here, and you'd be amazed at what you can do with the hardware that you have if you just put in a little bit of elbow grease to make it work for you.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, and I will say almost any Linux will work on almost any hardware. The question is how is it going to perform? And what are you willing to accept? If you have needs of a very fast operating system and you have something really old like that, I suggest looking at Puppy, see if that can be a solution for you. But, you know, 5-year-old Athlon 64, in reality, I don't think it's really that old.
No, it's still going to be plenty fast.
Yeah, so that's cool. And I'm very happy she's happy with it. Scratch is ultra interesting for kids. I think if adult loads it up, they just look at it and say, what is this? But for kids, I do think it is a great tool for them to play with.
I'll have to look into that, especially for my son. Okay, so Jackson Wright writes in. He says, "Hey, Cody and Dor, I've been distro hopping a bit lately, and I ran into a snag. When I'm using an independent distro or even some Debian-based distros, I am having trouble finding packages. There are some go-to packages that I used to use on Ubuntu, but I can't find them on Debian or independent-based distros. I've tried installing the Ubuntu Software Center, but there is no install button on a lot of the programs I find. When I try to use apt-get, I get an error message saying there is no installation candidate. The way I understand it, I need to add the Ubuntu repositories in order to have access to all of the software. How do I go about doing that? I appreciate the help and love the show. Jackson."
Well, if it's not a Ubuntu-based distribution, you cannot add those repos. It will not work. If you're using OpenSUSE, for instance, you have to use repositories that house OpenSUSE configured software. Okay. Now, that said, almost every piece of software is available to run on almost every version of Linux. The question is how much work you're going to have to do to get it on. With Ubuntu and PPAs, it's typically easy, super easy. If you're using Fedora or Red or OpenSUSE or whatever, something else, it might take a little bit of sudo config make install. It's a little bit trickier, a little bit more work. I ask everyone, please send me the more details you can give me, the better I am at answering questions. Me and Jackson did go back and forth a little bit. The problem is, I think for the most part, he wasn't using tab completion. He was just typing in a piece of software and hitting enter. Sudo apt-get install space, start to type the description of the application, hit tab. Because some distributions call it for instance, Audacity 2.13 or something else, not just the application name. There are typically ways you can convert a deb package into a RPM package or something like that. I kind of shy away from those tools. I beg people to, two things made me ask things from the viewers. If you have similar type questions, I need two pieces of information from you. What distribution are you running, 32 or 64, and what is it? And what piece of software are you trying to get on it? I guarantee you it's just one of those things. There's just one little piece of the puzzle that you're missing to be able to find what you need to find and get it on that computer.
Okay, yeah, good piece of advice there, Dor. Yeah, so yeah, it looks like you already got Jackson taken care of, though.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so if you guys are wondering that in the future, give him those two pieces of information, and we'll do what we can to help you out. And if it's something kind of new or semi-complicated, we'll definitely be able to bring it on the show. For instance, what was it? Within the past year, LibreOffice did an update where you had to jump through a bunch of extra hoops to install it on anything Ubuntu 10.10 or before. And I had to go through a few different forums and really search for that, whereas before it was just super easy. So sometimes, especially with upgrades of distributions, you know, sometimes if something was super easy, now it's going to be more difficult.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, great. All right. Oh, here we go. All right. Okay, here we go.
Deep breath.
Ashley Anderson writes, "Hey guys, it's been a while since I sent you guys some mail. Things are going well down here in the Atlanta area. Hope all is well in your corners of the U.S. of A. I caught the in-show reference about five shows back where you said my name. Cool. I appreciate it. It makes me feel like a part of the community. I saw on G+ that Dor went to Disney. I was there about 2 weeks after he was. Dor, I gotta say, if you walked around that hot place all day, all week, then you are a better man than I. I did one full day from 8 a.m. until 12 a.m., and it was hot, with a capital H. I was doing it for the kids, but I have never been so happy to buy those expensive bottles of water in my life. Yeah. Not sure I could have gone as much as Dor, so for that, sir, I salute you. Okay, on to the Linux stuff now. So I wanted to see what you guys thought about some Linux distros. I have a Gateway/Acer netbook with 2 gigs of RAM, maxed out, an Intel Atom N2600, and a 30-gigabyte SSD. I currently had Ubuntu 12.04 64-bit installed, and it was pretty good. It booted in 14 seconds and shut down in 3 seconds. In my interest in finding something that was leaner than Ubuntu, I have embarked on a new distro quest. My needs are really something that is a stable, fast, and a large number of available applications. I will not be using this for work, but rather when around the house. I use this toy for when I need to look something up or just playing on my netbook. I wanted something that has a big enough community that I could find the support I need, but light enough to be fast on this netbook. While I like niche distros, such as Puppy Linux, it's harder that I like to find the software that I want. Been there, done that. So, I wanted to go with something I figured had a larger user base. I have been courting Crunchbang, Linux Mint, Zubuntu, and Lubuntu. Crunchbang just does not offer the experience I like. Too minimalist. I'm testing out the latter three now, hoping to find a balance that suits my needs. I wanted to try to stay away from any distro that is downstream from Ubuntu due to all the significant system changes that are going into that distro at the moment. Was thinking about going to a Debian-based distro. Funny, the three distros I just mentioned I am testing are all Ubuntu-based. So finally, I will get to the point. What do you guys think would be a good distro to use on this netbook? I know there is no 100% answer to my question. However, I did want to see what you guys think, as well as what the community thought. It seems that a lot of good distros are going more towards the full desktop or tablet editions, and not so much the netbook platforms, i.e. Ubuntu dropping netbook edition after 10.10. Okay, gents, I appreciate your time. I love the show more than ever. Keep up the great work at Podnuts. This is 2012 Mother of the Year. Ashley signing off. LOL, sorry I could not resist. Later dudes, Ashley.
I want to first thank Ashley for teaching me a lesson. Because now every time I get an email from someone named Ashley, I'm like, oh, I don't know. I don't know. It's a person. I know that. You know, because we had Ashley from Flexi Keyboard emails on Android App Addicts.
Oh, okay.
Like, dude, whoa. We don't know if it's a girl. It could be a guy. And then they stopped and thought and said, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I thank him for that. I am educated. I will say he's in a quandary. He's in a pickle. He wants his cake and he wants to eat it too. He wants something with a huge user base, a huge assortment of software, but he doesn't want to use Ubuntu. Well, that's really super hard to fulfill. I will say, Debian is probably the only option for him because he used the word stable in there as well, too. If stability was not his prime objective, his prime directive kind of thing, honestly, Fedora might have been his next best thing because that has a big community behind it and a very large selection of software. I'll say the biggest similarities between Ubuntu and Fedora is that they are both changing stuff. You know, so those changes he might not like as well. I will say that. So I will say Debian is probably his number one thing he should look at. Now, I will say, if I was him, I would try one of two things. First off, it's on the netbook, which means he has another computer to play with while he's working on this netbook. Okay? That is necessary for what I'm about to say, okay? You're going to have to switch back and forth, see what's wrong, come over here, search, come back over here, fix it. You know, and do that a lot back and forth, okay? Ubuntu and Debian both have installation media that's called minimal installs. Debian minimal and Ubuntu minimal, and I will try to have notes for both of them in the show, okay? The reason I'm suggesting even still the Ubuntu minimal is because you start with nothing. No bloat, no nothing. You start with a TTY command shell. That's it on both of them. So the first time you log in, you have a very DOS-looking-esque command line saying log in. You put in your user credentials, enter, password, enter, and now you're at another command prompt. Now, from there, you start the process of building your distribution up like Legos. The first thing I'm going to suggest is if CrunchBang was too minimal, which I will say I understand absolutely what he means. CrunchBang is a fantastic distribution, but it's a little bit too minimal for some people out there. Okay, I would suggest the first thing he installs is, now with the Debian, I believe you have to SU. As soon as you log in, you hit SU, hit enter, type in your admin password, enter. Then from then on, you type apt-get install. You don't sudo. Okay, you can install sudo in Debian, but I don't think it comes by default. And the first thing you should install is XFCE, and it's probably going to be XFCE4. I honestly believe that is the best balance between weight, speed, functionality.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really heavy, but it does look a little bit pretty. It does have good functionality, and it seems to have enough plug-in type architecture for stuff to work. Now, I will say the second thing he's going to have to load is the XFCE login manager, or else he'll reboot the computer and he'll still be at a command prompt after logging in. It says it wants to use Slim login manager, so you might have to do a apt-get install slim. And then reboot, you should have a graphical login manager, login, and then you should have XFCE. Now from there, it's quite seriously, you have to stop and think to yourself, okay, now what do I use a computer for? I need a browser. Okay, what browser do I want? Now, guess what? Synaptic is not installed. Debian is not installed. Ubuntu Software Center is not installed. So you have to open up a command shell, and you have to either install one of those three, depending on what you're on, so you can start to install other applications. Or you can do it all from the command line. You can say sudo apt-get install Firefox, and then bam, you have your browser. Okay, what else do I need to do? You know, and then you can literally build up your distribution like that. And that is what I would honestly suggest for two reasons. One, he could probably get what looks like a normal Ubuntu desktop on his computer, yet it will be tons lighter because there's a lot of stuff not installed.
Right.
But two, and I mean this in all honesty, it is a great, great learning tool doing that at least once. So I would highly encourage Ashley, try that. And to be quite honest, that's what I want my next Linux video series to be. how to start off with minimal and build up your own custom desktop, your custom operating system, your custom distribution.
Well, I'm all for that. In fact, if you want to, I think it'd be a great learning experience for me too, because I've done some customization, but never from like a bare bones, for from the ground up. And I agree with you as far as XFCE. I use XFCE exclusively now, unless I'm trying a new distro and I just want to, at least for a couple of days, try their native desktop environment. Because sometimes it's really tweaked and built for that system. And
right.
But most of the time, I'm just like, this is too busy or it's too heavy. And even though I have a system to run it, it's like, why if you don't need it? So, but in his case, older netbook. Yeah, I was going to suggest Zubuntu right off the bat, the XFCE flavored of Ubuntu right there, but you want to get away from Ubuntu. So, some other options that I would suggest, other than Doors, sort of from the ground up, Manjaro. Mm-hmm. Manjaro would be good. It's XFCE flavored.
You're right, it is.
Arch. Yeah, which will be light, and you could do some configuring there. For those of you who have never used Arch before, their Pac-Man manager, I knew nothing about it at all. I'd never used it before. They have a great community. Their website is great. Their forums are really, really full-featured. I installed Manjaro maybe 3 or 4 months ago on an older laptop just to try it out. I had a few questions. It was answered immediately. It wasn't anything earth-shattering, but really good support there. So I would suggest trying Manjaro because it brings kind of what Dor's saying with what you want as far as going away from any Ubuntu-based distros. So I would suggest give that a try, see if it runs.
Well, and I will throw out there, I honestly neglected Arch. If there is a piece of software in existence, I guarantee you it's available on Arch, okay? The Arch User Repository, the AUR, technically speaking, is a little bit Wild West-ish. So you got to be careful with what you install from there. But I guarantee you, if there's a piece of software you heard about, you might have to wait a week. It will be on Arch. And in this, to be honest, I will say, I'm not a man who likes pre-configured, pre-compiled Arch distributions. Because if you're going to use Arch, use Arch. But I will say, if you don't want to go through the first time loading and configuration of everything, Manjaro, I honestly think, is the best for usability and you still have Arch.
Yeah, and I liked it so much, I'm actually going to, once I get this thing that Matthew was talking about with doing the Grub Legacy setup, I'm going to use it to throw it on my laptop on a partition.
Cool.
So, yeah, very cool. All right. That's it for the emails. We're going to play one voicemail and get out of here a little earlier than expected. Dor, can you queue up that second shorter email?
Yes, I can. It should be coming here in a second.
Yeah. And in the time being, please, if you are interested in coming on to Podnets Daily, we are looking for guests. You can email me at cody@podnets.com. And we will send you a list of available dates, and you can come on that show. We recently had two awesome guests come on. Dor interviewed one, I interviewed the other, and those shows are coming soon. One of the guests was suggested by a listener, and the other one is one of my favorite podcasters who answered the call that I just made to you to come on the show. I interviewed him last night, and that's going to be a great episode. So if you have any sort of, if you're a computer tech, if you're doing a computer repair, or if you're a representative of a company and have a product or service that you would like to speak about, we can throw you on to either Podnuts or Podnuts Daily, and we would love to have you on the show because we could get some great content going there to help do what much of what Dor was talking about earlier, helping to expand the network. Also, if you haven't already, Scott Moulton recently did a new episode of My Hard Drive Died with Dor, and that was a good show. It was a really good show. Talked more about the XFAT file system and kind of gave him an update. I'll give you a little teaser. He does talk about Prism a little bit, which from a hard drive expert was a very interesting listen as far as what can be tracked and what the government might be doing as far as utilizing hard drives for the so much data they say they might be collecting. So it was a very, very interesting listen. Also, at this point, I want to remind everyone, OLF is just weeks away. We've already started planning more and more items for our trip there. Please send us if you haven't already, add us on Google Plus, because last year what we did is we set up a Google event page. So if you're following either Dora or myself on Google Plus, you can set up a link to that page and see photos that we post throughout the day. We can literally have it just set up on our phones where we click a photo, it gets uploaded right to the page. We'll try to keep it as G-rated as possible. We didn't do anything super crazy last year, but that would be a great way to kind of follow us at OLF. So, and for everyone who has added me on Google Plus lately, and Dora as well, I'm sure, thank you very much for your support. Okay, we got that voicemail loaded up from Paul. And I will say, Paul, thank you for the reminder. We did find it, and here it is.
Yes, this is Paul from Louisville, Kentucky. And I was just wondering, Dor, over the years, I've heard you say that you really like Linux Wine. And I've really never had much success with it. And I was looking at your DVDs online, and I noticed that I couldn't find anything listed about Wine, and I was just wondering if you cover that topic in your DVDs. If not, could you direct me to some online videos that are good instruction for Wine? Also heard you say that you are a big fan of Larry Bushy, as I am, and I was just wondering if you were ever going to try to get him on the links for the rest of the show. Thanks a lot. Love your show. Bye.
Thank you for the voicemail, Paul, and thank you for being so patient. Paul had initially sent that email to us last month, and somehow it got lost in the shuffle. Much speaking to what Dor was saying earlier, if you know a better way to organize email or how you do it, send in that information to us, because we do occasionally lose some things temporarily, but we found it and we got it aired on the show. Thank you very much, Paul.
Yeah, I'll say I don't cover anything really about Wine in the videos, and it's partially because it's kind of not needed in those video series, and I mean it like this. If you know two things about Wine, you will be able to either get anything working or it will never work. Three. Number one, there is no USB support in Wine, period. I.e., iTunes in Wine can't work right because you can never update your device because that requires USB. So, no USB support in Wine. Supposedly it's coming, but it's not there yet. Two, applications like Play on Linux. Okay. Wine itself is like a set of tools. Okay. We do not know how to use that tool whatsoever. We don't. Because it's just an application that we think of, well, install using Wine, and then, okay, and then it should work, right? No. When an application gets installed via Wine, there is a boatload of configuration options that can happen. Applications like Play on Wine know what are the correct parameters that an application should be installed with. So I encourage anyone who wants to look at Wine, download an application like Play on Linux. I believe the other one is called Wine Doors. And that has list right there of things you can install using Wine. So you don't even have to go look for the stuff. It's right there. It's very easy to use. Third, Wine HQ. Wine HQ is like a repository of information regarding Wine and the success rate people have had with given applications. I.e., you can go to that website and you can look up, for instance, games, applications, and it will tell you whether or not the application will work or what kind of success you will have with the application once you try to install it using Wine.
Okay. Yeah, I myself used to try to use it for certain things, but I don't use that much anymore. But yeah, at least sending along some information to him and maybe finding out what he needs to use it for. Maybe if there's a good alternative on Linux would be a good thing. So thank you, Paul, for the voicemail. And thank you, Dor, for answering it.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that's going to be the end of our show this week. Dor, where can we find you?
Podnuts.com, easiest way. Check me out on Google Plus. If you add me to a to a circle in Google Plus, ding me and let me know you're a Linux user, so I can put you in my appropriate circles.
There you go. And I'm Cody Cooper. You can follow me on Google Plus. Just search for Cody Cooper. Or if you want to send in an email to me, especially about the Podnuts Daily episode or appearance, please send it to cody@podnuts.com. Please send in any emails to the show to mail@podnuts.com, and send in all voicemails to 7076-PODNUT, and we will play it on the show just like we did this week. Thank you very much for listening, and please remember that Linux is not just for the rest of us, it is for all of us. Good night.
Are you a computer repair business owner? Register today for the ACRBO Summit. Expert speakers covering a range of topics to include growing your business, ways to market, tech discussions, and more. Visit www.acrbo.com/summit. Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.